Welcome to The Business Show. We believe that our journey through this world is one we must take together, expanding, learning, and growing as a united force. We know that history is being made right now, and the decisions we make today will shape our tomorrow. These decisions will not only impact us, but will define the future for generations to come. If we don't make the right choices now, we risk creating a future we don't want. That's why we're here, to slay the dragons of the modern world and to face the challenges it brings head on. The future demands that we come together to tackle these challenges, and the only way forward is through unity and collaboration. Let's rise together, undivided but united. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy.
My name is Wanlebo. We are thrilled to have all of you here as we dive into a timely conversation on generational shifts and their impact on business, culture, and society. As the world continues to evolve, so do the generations that shape it. From the steadfast values of baby boomers to the activism and digital fluency of Gen Zs, and now the rise of Gen Alpha. Generation that is redefining how we engage with technology, business, and leadership. To help us navigate this, I am joined by Dimpo, who will be guiding us through some of today's insights, Mbali, who will also be keeping an eye on the chat and bringing audience questions, and lastly, our guest, Bronwyn, who we have today. With that being said, let's get started. I'll hand over to Mbali to introduce our guest.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Wandile. Good morning, everybody, and welcome once again. It's such a privilege to introduce our guest today, Ms. Bronwyn Williams. She's a futurist, economist, and business trends analyst. She has over a decade's worth of experience in strategic management, trend research, and strategic foresight. She has consulted for clients in public and private sectors across the world. Part economist, part strategist, Bronwyn's particular areas of expertise include fintech trends, alternative economic models, and sustainable future designs. She co-authored The Future Starts Now, book published by Bloomsbury UK, and Rescuing Our Republic, a thought-provoking book with interviews from a diverse group of public intellectuals, business leaders, and political mavericks discussing tangible ways South Africa can rescue itself from itself. She's a columnist for leading business and technology publications and is a sought-after media commentator on future trends and economic trajectories for network channels, including CNBC Africa and ENCA in South Africa. Bronwyn has delivered hundreds of keynotes to audiences across dozens of countries. Her top speaking topics center around futuronomics, that is the future trajectory and potential of social and political economic forces that shape our world and how we connect and trade with each other. Secondary speaking topics include consumer trends, generational cycles, microeconomic forecasts, politics, philosophy, economics, change management, foresight strategy and techniques, and risk management. She is a partner at Flux Trends and an associate at Futurist.com. Bronwyn's research focuses on how macroeconomics trends and emerging technologies will impact businesses, industries, and nations in the short and long term. The clients that she has worked with include top 40 JC listed companies, the South African Reserve Bank, Dubai Future Forum, various African government departments, and global business leaders. She also guest lectures at leading business schools such as Duke, Gibbs, Parsons, New School of Design, UCT, and the University of Johannesburg. She's a member of the Association of Professional Futurists, a volunteer with the Millennium Project, an advisor at the Lifeboat Foundation, and a Futures Fellow with the UNDP. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you agree with me by saying that we are privileged to listen to such a person with such diverse knowledge, and we're bound to get valuable insights this morning. I hand over to you, Wandy.
Thank you, Mbali. To start off, let's look at the defining traits of the different generations. Bronwyn, in your experience, what are some of the key characteristics that distinguish baby boomers, millennials, Gen Z, and Gen Alpha?
Yeah, so let's give you just a little bit of context in generational studies. Of course, you've mentioned those different generation cohorts there. A lot of people criticize us in the trend space for looking at generations at all. We say, you know, that's like stereotypes. It's like making stereotypes between what men and women are, like stereotyping people across their age. But there's a little bit more science that comes into it, and that is that we are a product of the society that we live in. As much as it is disingenuous to say stereotype someone based on what country they come from, there's still a reality that different countries have different cultures. In different countries, it's acceptable to dress or to talk in certain ways, right? We understand this. We understand that if we go to the Middle East during a certain religious holiday, we need to cover up in different ways than we do in Johannesburg. There are fundamental differences in the places that we're born in and to how we grow up. There's a cultural and a political and economic context that is tied to our physical space. By the same token, there is a cultural and economic and political and social context according to the time period we were born into. So let's start with the baby boomers, who are not the oldest generation among us. There's the silent generation that is older than the baby boomers, but you are unlikely to interact with the silent generation member in the workplace. They are definitely past retirement age. They're quite aged at this time. They would be the living ancestors, if you want to put it that way. Certainly your great-grandparents, not just your grandparents. But the baby boomer generation is still in the workplace, although they are retiring out of it quite fast. The baby boomer generation was born into a very specific cultural and political context. They were the generation that was born at the end of World War II, which was an undeniable global phenomenon. And if you were born in the middle of the war, before the war, as the silent generation was, you would have been born into a very different, much more chaotic world than if you were born into the newly won world that was a new dawn. And again, you can start to see parallels with South African more recent context there too. If you were born as a baby boomer, you were born to this new world. The war had been won. The world was full of hope and people were having lots of babies. That's why they are literally called the baby boom generation, because post-war, that scarcity mindset shifted. People were optimistic and they had a whole lot of babies as men returned back from the war. And you had this very big generation that was born very quickly as families started and new societies were built in the wake of all this chaos. Now, the baby boomers grew up. They were therefore born in your sort of late 1940s to early 1950s. If you're sort of a millennial like I am, they would be your parents. If you're a little bit younger, they would be your grandparents. If you're in the workplace, they are probably sitting on the board, to be honest. And if you look at politics, they are the ones that are currently in charge. So Cyril, our president, would definitely be a baby boomer. He's of that generation, right? So that was the context they were born into, this context of optimism. But there are other markers that mark this generation. This is the generation that grew up to be the hippies of the 1960s. They were the flower children that wore flowers in their hair. Again, is it surprising that a generation that has been characterized by the end of the war would be anti-war and would be protesters? Probably not. That kind of makes sense too. So that's just a very sort of simple, a couple of data points that show that the place and the time that you were born into matters. Those are basically your baby boomers. They are still in power. They were the biggest generation at the time, so they had an outsized impact on politics. They had more votes, very literally, because there were more people born into that bulge. Thereafter, you had the next generation, and this generation was Generation X. So Generation X is also in the workplace. They are the generation currently that you'd be interacting with who are inheriting power from the baby boomers as the baby boomers retire. So they're likely to be your boss in the next 5 to 10 years. They are the generation that was born in the 1960s to sort of a mid-1970s-ish, or actually going up all the way up to 1980 if you want to be quite specific. But effectively, Generation X was categorized as being quite a small generation. They were the children of both the silent generation and a little bit of the baby boomer generation. And what cultural context they share in common is that they were known as the latchkey generation. They would have been children and young teenagers in the 70s and 80s when the results of the baby boomers' hippie movements started coming into play. If the baby boomer hippies pushed for female rights, generation, they became the women whose families were affected by those rights. And what the most critical thing that affected Generation X was the fact that so many of them were born to single mothers, the product of the sexual revolution, and so many of them were products of broken homes. Many of them were single and only children too. So Generation X is characterized currently in the workplace as being highly independent, but also perhaps a little bit cynical and unsocialized. They are uniquely ill-equipped to be the next generation of leaders in the workplace. They were brought up to be lone wolves. They brought themselves up to a large extent. They were brought up in the era where you still had freedom from your parents, and you had so much freedom, in fact, that governments used to put messages on the television asking parents to remind them where their children were. Do you know where your children are? That's how little parental guidance Generation X had. So highly independent, currently coming into power reluctantly, right? They're not the sort of manager that knows how to deal with you in Generation Z, which you're going to get to in a second, because you have a very different cultural context. But just after Generation X, you have the infamous millennial generation, of which Carmen and myself are a part of, your sort of slight elders in the workplace. We are also a big generation because we are the children of the baby boomer generation. So you had a large generation, had a lot of children. Largely, that's kind of how this plays out. And we were brought up by very different parents to Generation X. This is why we're so different. If Generation X's parents let them just do what themselves and effectively be self-raising flowers who grew themselves up and looked after themselves and cooked their own dinner and made their own rules and had no rules, millennials were brought up by a lot more helicopter parents. They were brought up with a lot more parental competition. We were brought up to, you know, every child has its own prize. We were brought up to expect prosperity because our parents were a very wealthy generation. The baby boomers were. They were born into this post-war prosperity. And they set a whole lot of expectations for our generation. But the millennial generation has another key point in context that we all have in common globally, and that is that we graduated into the middle of the 2008 recession. So we are a generation that is characterized by having high expectations but low reality. The reality is that millennials are struggling to buy property even as younger people are able to buy property. Millennials have struggled to define themselves as a generation and to succeed as a generation. There are very few millennial case studies of huge success in the world of business or the world of politics. And a lot of that is to do with the economic and political sort of conflicts and crisis and lack of opportunity that this generation graduated into. So if millennials graduated into the 2008 recession, suddenly faced a world without jobs for this large generation, they also reached maturity. In other words, started trying to settle down, start a family at the same time that COVID happened, right? So you have all these sort of massive setbacks. So millennials kind of be characterized as this kind of treading water generation. Generations tried to find work-life balance, that's tried to find self-actualization through social media, but never grew up in a world where social media existed when we were children, but rather we've kind of grown up alongside it. So the cultural context of the internet and of the social platforms that you use has been largely characterized by millennials. Many millennials are freelancers. They don't necessarily have corporate jobs. Although many would like some sort of financial security, millennials in general have chosen freedom over financial security. So you'll find a lot of people in my generation are entrepreneurs working in social media, working in marketing, trying to fulfill their passion through whatever tools are available, but not necessarily achieving that financial success that was expected of them. So there is a kind of sense that this was known as a sort of Peter Pan generation. It took quite a long time to achieve those markers of maturity, but that's kind of where we are. And then, of course, you've got Generation Z, which is a very clear and distinct generation, particularly in the South African context. Many of you will fall into that generation. And Generation Z is the generation also known in South Africa as the born free generation. This is the generation that was born at the end of apartheid, and also the generation that graduated right into the COVID lockdown crisis. So Generation Zs, to sort of give the perspective of the older people in the room, are seen by older colleagues, by those baby boomers who life was very easy for, Generation X, who been lone wolves and done everything by themselves, tend to see Generation Z as being quite frustrating to work with. But they've got to remember, Generation Z did not be socialized into the workplace. They work from home and studied at university from home during lockdown periods. And they grew up with global consciousness, or you did, thanks to not just growing up alongside social media like the millennials, but rather having social media in your midst really for your whole life. So Generation Z is therefore quite a social generation. You are the children of Generation X, the rebellious lone wolf generation. And as such, we see a whole lot of compare and contrast elements with your generation too. So if Generation X was all about drinking, smoking, drugs and excess, Generation Z is all about clean living, right? About teetotalism, around rejecting sort of party culture, around being in bed at 9, as we're picking up in our research, right? So there's almost a cultural conservatism, even if there is a global progressive consciousness among your generation, which is also the advent of having access to all the world's information. Your generation is the first generation that older generations have not been able to hide information from. Information for generations that grew up without social media was locked. It was projected through large media companies, through your television. It was a one-way conversation. You've been part of the conversation your whole life. And that's why you have global consciousness over issues, whether it's the war in Gaza, whether it is climate change, whether it's what's going on in America. You know what's going on. You have a view and you have context. So your perspective is a lot broader than a generation born in a time where information was much more siloed, much more dependent on where you were born in the world. So those are just some sort of sketch as to what the generations are and some of the critical markers that make each generation different from the other. But Generation Z is really the generation everyone is interested in at the moment. You are the young people in the workplace. You are older teenagers going up to now 30 years old. So the warning is that up until now, the problems you faced have been problems caused by older people. But pretty soon, as you start reaching your 30s, you either become part of the problem or part of the solution for the next generation, because right behind you are Generation Alpha, who have now started turning 14 years old, right? So they're now teenagers. They now are catching the interest of marketers and social media companies who are trying to sell these 14-year-olds anti-aging treatments and anti-aging skincare already. They are very much seen as consumers. And when businesses start looking at people as consumers, they start to take their voice and their vote seriously. But bear in mind, of course, this generation is going to look to you with both criticism and with respect to a certain degree in terms of the choices they're going to make. So what we kind of see now is a baton change in terms of the spotlight, in terms of where media is paying attention, from Generation Z, who has been very much front and center the last 10 years, towards Generation Alpha.
Oh, wow, that's so interesting. I'm still shocked at the point you made about we are shaped by the place and time we are in. That is very, very interesting to know. Mbali, can you please check the chat for us? Are there any insights or questions?
There's a question from Carmen asking, how do we create hope as a united generation?
Yeah, that's a really big question, and that's a choice that each of us have to make. So this is the thing, again, with stereotypes and being shaped by the time and space that you're in. You can either use those markers as a way to isolate yourself, as a way to develop almost sort of, we can use the analogy of nationalist tendencies, to think of other generations as being antagonistic or part of or a competitor to your space in terms of power and wealth and money in society, or you can see it as an opportunity to build bridges and to have those conversations. And that's the challenge of every generation. It's very easy to point fingers at the other, whether that other is another nationality or another race or another sex or another age group. It's a lot harder to work on the reality that we all people, even though we have different perspectives in time and space as to where we were born and when we were born, we're all currently sharing the same, as we call it in sort of futures terms, long now, which is the part of the present that we all get to touch. And the long now is a really interesting way to try and build those bridges, because the long now covers the period of time that started when the oldest person alive today was born, So that would be around about 100, and depending on what statistics you believe, 120 years in the past. So going kind of back to the turn of the 1900s. And the long now extends into the future. That will be the future of the youngest person born today, which will probably be another, based on how longevity is going, 140 years into the future. And that's the time space that we get to sort of metaphorically hold each other's hands through time. And if we can broaden our perspective to see that, we can see how even as young people like yourselves today, you're going to have an impact, because those little children, and there's a new generation being born from this year, Generation Beta. So we don't know anything about them yet. They're just being born right now from this year. You're going to be a part of their perspective. You're going to hold their proverbial hand going forward for the rest of your life and the rest of their life. That's the impact you're going to have. And likewise, you are being influenced by people who were born in 1900 or 1910, those like really old silent generation and hero generations that are before us, that are still in our midst. And if we can see that perspective, then we can be perhaps a little bit wiser about being future ancestors, because even if you are young and you're 20 years old, you got to see yourself already as being a future ancestor. And are you going to be a wise ancestor that generations look back with awe and with respect, or are you going to be a poor ancestor? Like, I'm unfortunate to say, many people of my generation will be poor ancestors because we didn't use our generational dividend when we could. We wasted our 20s complaining about other generations rather than solving problems for the next, right? You get to sort of choose your place as an individual and as a cohort, what impact you're going to make.
Sure, thank you for that. And I think a question that I would add, Bronwyn, you said something so interesting about how the Gen Z generation has always been a part of the conversation. The information is not hidden. What then is the danger of misinformation? Because it's easy for me to just start a TikTok, you know, without any credentials, and then speak on a topic. So as much as it's great that we are part of this conversation and we have access to information, is that danger of misinformation too?
Yes, absolutely. So I think there's a great analogy there that makes it very simple to understand, is that in general, abundance is a good thing, and scarcity is, of course, a deprivation and something we should work to correct, whether you're talking about food, whether you're talking about housing, whatever you're talking about. The first port of call should be to remove that, so that's a deprivation, right? And we know this. I mean, we live in South Africa, we've got real scarcity and challenges we've got to overcome, right? But at the same time, abundance brings with it its own sets of dangers, and we can use food as an analogy, right? So not having enough food is, of course, the worst thing. Being actually starving, having malnutrition when you're a child, this is clearly a problem, you've got to solve it. But at the same time, having access to too much food, you get all those other sorts of illnesses of excess that come along with obesity, things like higher risks of diabetes, and higher risk of heart attack, and all of those sorts of things. So when we have access to information, that is first and foremost a good thing. We should never fall into the trap of saying, because abundance comes with challenges, we should go back to scarcity. I mean, you'd never do that with food. Yes. You'd never say that because people have access to chocolate bars, you know, we should put limits on the amount of food anyone could have, right? We should just be ration food. That's not the way we should think about it. Same thing with information. Instead of seeing that as we need to censor information and impose top-down rules and regulations or rationing, again, to use the food analogy, we need to learn wisdom, much like we have to learn balance, and we have to learn good eating habits in a world where we do have access to more food than we do require. We have to do the same thing with our information diet. So recognizing first and foremost that we are privileged to live in a world of abundance, much like when it comes to food, grocery stores full of any product you can want from any part of the world, whenever you want it, assuming you've got enough money, of course. But still, even not particularly wealthy people have access to far more calorific content than previous generations did across the world. Same thing with information. We've got access to all this information, but not all of it is equally nutritious for our spiritual and our mental and physical well-being, right? We have to learn judgment there. So the problem is no longer a problem of scarcity, it's a problem of wisdom. And unfortunately, many people try to outsource that wisdom, either to a thought leader to do your thinking for you, or towards some sort of a algorithm or bot to determine what is quality and what is not quality for you. But ultimately, you have to make that decision yourself. And that's a discipline you're going to have to learn. It's very much like looking after your physical body. You can't outsource your physical well-being to anyone else. You're still the one that has to pick up the weights and go to gym. You're still the one who has to choose what you're going to eat and to stop eating. eating when you're full. Same thing with your information diet. You have to learn that wisdom for yourself. And a lot of that will be through trial and error. But the most important thing you can do for misinformation is to rely on no body, no platform, no person as being a superior source of wisdom to yourself, because everyone is flawed and biased in their own way. And perhaps the best we can hope for is being flawed and biased in our own way, and then work to correct and improve ourselves rather than sort of try to correct and balance someone else, which we're never going to have control over.
Awesome. Bronwyn, I'd like to hear a little bit more. You mentioned something really interesting with regards to shifts in consumer behavior and the marketplace in particular across all these different generations. You mentioned that it is the millennials who were doing the drinking, and now we've moved over to like Gen Z, which prefers a more cleaner lifestyle. And then all of a sudden, we now also have Gen Alpha, which at 14 has already been, you know, like a focus for the marketplace. And it's like, yes, but your money is coming from a Gen Z. You don't yet move in the marketplace to make your own money. So maybe if you could speak to us a little bit about the shift in the marketplace, the different behaviors and how businesses are basically just trying to cater for all these different generations simultaneously.
Yeah, well, firstly, a little word of criticism, but marketers do tend to fetishize youth, right? Marketers tend to think that, and I'm not here to say that youth is inferior to age or age is inferior to youth, but rather marketers tend to focus perhaps unjustly on young people. And that's largely because we have these cultural contexts saying like the youth is the future and all the rest of it. And that made sense in a world where you had your baby boomer and millennial generations, which were very large, right? So the sort of primary reason why marketers look down the generational pyramid is because there used to be more people there than up top, because we had high growth rates, particularly after World War II, which is when most of modern marketing business came into play. Now, that's no longer universally true. It is very obvious that birth rates are declining, and that Generation Z, even for South Africa, is likely to be our biggest generation. Right. For other parts of the world, the millennial generation was the last expanding rather than contracting generation. And that's for most of the so-called weird West, most of the Western world where we look to for cultural sort of supremacy, you know, this whole idea of sort of like the Western culture, Northern America, Europe, Australia, you know, even Japan, those very Western consumer cultures, they've been in decline already. The baby boomer generation had millennials, but then pretty much populations started shrinking, which means that marketers who are looking for growth and for connecting with the future actually have to start looking at older people, because the future is old. The future is not the children. The future is the grandparents, very literally, in very many parts of the world. Africa is a bit different. We still have a youth bulge, but based on our current birth rates here in South Africa, Generation Z will likely be the biggest part of that bulge, right? But marketers used to follow the bulge in terms of more people equal more money or more potential people to sell to. But that has to shift when you have this global perspective that more people are over the age of 35 than under the age of 35 worldwide. That's the reality. Mm-hmm. So what becomes really interesting from a Generation Z to A perspective, or ZA, if you want to put it that way, it very much is a ZA generation from a, like an African perspective, in that young people in the African continent are going to have a larger weight than young people in the rest of the world, because they are going to be more of you than they are of them. And that's a huge power and a huge privilege to look at. So you shouldn't be surprised when marketers and political parties and messages start to target you, because you are one of the only sources of very literal growth going forward. Young Africans, young Americans, not so many of them. Young Europeans, not so many of them. Young Africans, there are a lot of you, and that's where eyes are going to focus. And there's going to be a lot of competition for your money, for your brains, for your attention, for your ideological support. So there's a huge amount of power that comes along with that, even if you do feel disenfranchised, if you do feel like you don't have enough of a vote in terms of having enough money in the market. People are going to look at you, and you are going to be contested in terms of mis and disinformation, in terms of marketing, in terms of propaganda. You are important. You are extremely valuable. You are potentially the only source of growth, not just for African businesses, but for international businesses too. So you have to be on your guard there in terms of where you spend your time and attention and your money.
Awesome. Maybe just as a follow-up, it's very interesting to hear that. I just wonder how we contrast that with, yes, in terms of numbers, we are available. But if we look at countries, particularly in South Africa and economic activity across the continent, what does that mean then? So you're vying for my attention, but I might not necessarily be in the financial position as the generation just before me to actually make the purchase. So how do they contrast those two?
Well, I think you'd be, particularly in African context, your generation does have more purchasing power than previous generations. This is just the legacy of colonization and apartheid and all the rest of it. Your generation, as the born free generation, had access to opportunities and even the legal ability to own property and wealth and such things that were previously denied. So in your case, you probably do have more disposable income than your parents do, maybe even at this point in time, never mind at the point in time when they were in your position at your age. Mm-hmm. So that's a reality, another reason why you are more of a sort of hot property there. In terms of owning global share of profit, share of wealth, absolutely, Africans do not own that share of wealth, but a large part of that is in your hands to turn those trends around, depending again on where you're spending your time and your attention. Now, I recently wrote an article for Brainstorm magazine that looked at this issue. Looked at the issue of technological advancement and where businesses are looking for growth. And we can use the example, as since we are South Africans, of what apps you use to get around in, right? Are you using like a Bolt or an Uber, or using like a Jumia service if you're trying to order goods and services? And the truth is that we're using these apps and they're coming here for growth because there's more people that are moving more places that have disposable income, even though it's small amounts of income. And they're coming here and we are paying them, it's effectively sort of like a rental income to get around and move around our own cities and buy our own products and services from our own businesses, right? So we're paying sort of like these tributes to foreign digital landlords. And we use Uber instead of using Jumia for whatever reason. Why do we do this? Why do we prefer to pay our rents to foreigners rather than to fellow Africans? Why do we not support our own businesses there? You know, these are choices that reinforce where wealth pools, where wealth is drawn from. So just be very, very careful when people come in with sort of like a digital inclusion and health inclusion. It's all these digital services that feel like they're really, really cheap. But at the same time, who's actually getting that tribute? Who's getting that? Who's that middleman? And why aren't we supporting our own middlemen? I mean, we could argue about whether the middleman should exist or not, but clearly it's useful to be able to order food from an app or to use an app to get a taxi in a crime-ridden country. But at the same time, why do we support voluntarily sort of foreign financial interests instead of our own? Where is our self-confidence there, and where do we sort of start paying the price of our values in terms of the sorts of future that we want, that sort of convenience in the future versus long-term profit or loss? And the same thing takes place with like our other scarce resources. And you're a scarce resource. This is the point that I'm making. Our human resources are scarce resources. Our citizens are scarce resources that everyone finds very attractive. But we have other good stuff here, like Carmen talks about. We've got platinum, we've got gold, we've got land, we've got seafront property in seafront, you know, and these things we sell to foreigners far cheaper, you know, than perhaps what they're worth. And we sell away our birthright piece by piece in order to pay for our present. And, you know, like, what are we thinking about there in terms of what we're leaving behind? And sure, we can look at previous generations with anger or with pity or with sadness as to what's already been lost and sold. But we need to really think very carefully. And the truth is, we have sold a lot of our businesses are owned by foreigners on our stock market. A lot of our property is owned by foreigners who don't pay taxes, yeah, but they get to sit in our fancy properties, you know, and push up our rental rates. I mean, if you're from Cape Town, you know this all too well. But, you know, what are we doing about the future? And the most important part of the future is, again, as I reiterate, you, your generation, the people. This is an asset that can be bought much cheaper than you are worth. If you're doing remote work for countries that are paying you less than what they're paying people that live in their own countries for exactly the same job, I mean, we wouldn't stand for that here. If like one race is paid more for a job than another, we have laws in place to stop that. But from an international scale, yeah, you know, South Africans can be paid a lot less than Americans or British working for those companies, just because we accept that, right? So like, have we developed a global consciousness about our worth? And about our worth of our continent and the people in it, most importantly. And I think that's the big challenge for your generation.
I love that. I love that. Thanks, Bronwyn.
Yeah, and as Carmen said, supporting local businesses. Yeah, this is a vote of confidence, and it's a vote of self-confidence in our future, not their future.
Yeah. Yeah. Bali, do we have any questions in the chat?
Yes, so we have a question from Ubongi, and she asks, what are some examples of brands that have successfully adapting their market strategies to appeal to multiple generations?
Oh, well, I'm probably the wrong person to ask about that. I think you can go and look after yourself. You'll know exactly if a brand is attaching to your generation or to someone else's too. I think there are a lot of brands that are getting that wrong. A lot of brands that try and segment against generations are missing the point. The point of generational studies is not to say like you're targeting this one or that one, but rather to understand the context and the needs and the challenges that people of different ages face, which are clearly very different, but more importantly, to understand the differences at the same age generations face. Like, there are challenges that anyone will face when they're going through puberty. I mean, like, puberty is the same whether you are, whether you were born in 1950 or whether you're born in 1980, those challenges are the same. But the challenges when it comes to access to the property market or access to credit are very different for an 18-year-old in the year 2025 than they would have been for an 18-year-old in the year 1980. And of course, you can layer on all the other intersectional challenges that come along with race and sex and gender and nationality too at those points to get a more comprehensive picture as to what those needs are. So in general, brands that are doing well are brands that have empathy for the challenges that different people who have different perspectives across space and time are facing at this point in time, and not being exclusionary. So I think that's a real challenge that we have to look at. And I think that brands have not done a particularly good job at empathy in building, in particularly in our sort of South African context. As much as it's important for us to support local brands, it's also important for local brands to support local consumers, right? Sure. To be inclusive, make sure that you deliver for like a real basic, like, do you deliver to where people live, or do you only deliver in suburbs? Do you choose people who live in, rural areas or in town, former townships, a premium to deliver their products? Like, that's not empathetic. Mm-hmm. That's the opposite of empathetic. But at the same time, it's an opportunity for local entrepreneurs to step into that gap and to say, I will serve market, and I will serve it in a way that they deserve to be served, not an exclusionary price-based kind of a way. So I haven't really answered your question, but I'm no longer in the brand and marketing space there. Carmen will be able to answer those questions with examples far more than I am, but I can speak to the sort of principles as to where things are falling apart and where they're going right.
Now, I think you have answered it, because one of the questions which I think you've answered that I was going to ask was in relation to what you said about as Gen X, Gen Z, you're in a position where you slowly are becoming the problem, but also part of the solution for the next generation. So my question was going to be, how then do you go about becoming the solution? And I think part of what you said about servicing the consumers and looking at the local economies or informal economies and seeing how you can contribute to that.
Yeah, marketing is really simple. Like, from a very broad perspective, you got to meet your customer where they are. And again, that means understanding their space and their context in space and time. I mean, it should be so simple, right? And not assuming that people have access to transport to a particular place, not assuming that it's easy for someone to pick up goods at your store, even though that's going to involve several different operators to get there, opposed to delivering it to where people are. Just understanding that context, and also understanding, much like I said earlier, like, brands tend to focus on young people rather than old people, even as they become more old people than young people. Brands continue to focus on urban as opposed to rural consumers, even if those numbers don't add up. Everyone sort of chases the same kind of safe bet. And that's where you end up losing so much market share. This is why Sheen and Samu come into South Africa, and South Africa's buy from them, because they're meeting people where they are, what they need, when local businesses aren't. So this is a kind of sermon for both sides. On the one hand, we must support our own businesses as consumers, because if we don't, we're going to get more of the other. Like, a consumption is a vote for a future that we want. If you spend your rands at Mr. Price, Mr. Price's share price goes up, and they more Mr. Price's. If you spend your rands Sheen, well, then Sheen gets more money and Sheen takes more market share. This is a choice. But at the same time, businesses need to service people to a level that foreign competitors can't. So it's a call to excellence on our business side, and it's a call to self-worth and self-confidence on our consumer side. And that's the challenge for Africa, to build our own markets where we are creating quality products that service our local needs and that build resilient, deep economies where we have suppliers and consumers and citizens that are all kind of working together there. But I want to make another point in terms of the young generation being part of problems, part of solutions. Yes, absolutely, your consumption behaviors, your attention behaviors, the kind of posts you reshare, the kind of products you purchase, well, we're going to get more of those. The more you spend your time, attention, the more we get. But the other challenge with your generation globally and in a South African context is simply showing up. If you don't show up, you can't be part of the solution. And here we have to talk about youth voter apathy rights, right? You know, like the fact that, I don't know how many of you are aware of this. I love saying this because nobody gets it. If your generation, the Generation Z, I'm just speaking to you generally now, had shown up to vote last year, your generation, because you are one of the only privileged large young generations left on the world, if you had shown up to vote in our elections last year, your generation could have chosen whichever president you wanted, and the rest of us, all of the rest of the generations, would have had to suck it up. Sure. That's how much power you had, and yet young people didn't show up. Generation X showed up at a greater rate than Generation Z did. You know, Carmen's generation showed up. The disillusioned lone wolf Gen X's showed up cynically, but they didn't show up. And Generation Z didn't. Your generation didn't show up. You didn't use the agency that you had. And that agency is something that if you don't use it, you lose it. It's very clear. It's like a privilege, any privilege. A privilege is only useful if you use it. And that's an indictment, because if you sitting out is also a choice. It's also a vote. It's a vote status quo. And if you're happy with the status quo, that's great. You're welcome to vote in that direction. But if you're not, but you're also not using your agency, then yes, you do become a part of that problem. So I think the big sort of message to anyone while they're still lucky enough to be young, and particularly lucky enough to be young in a context where being young gives you the momentum and the balance of power, is to use it and to use it while you can, right? For your generation and for the following generations there.
Something you touched on, Bronwyn, you mentioned how, okay, I'm just going to rephrase it, and I love the point you made on how Gen Z does not realize how privileged we are, and we keep on missing the point of how privileged we are through technology shifts, through access to information, and so on and so on. Speaking about digital inclusion, how has this impacted the use of technology within businesses for the Gen Z generation and Gen Alpha?
Our businesses are definitely trying to use technology to get to your generation. As I said, everyone's eyes are on how to connect with Gen Z. I mean, this is what we get called into companies just to speak to all the time. And technology is absolutely part of that. Technology, of course, can be used as both a sort of a weapon and a tool, particularly when it comes to shaping minds and shaping consciousness and shaping world order. And we spoke about mis- and disinformation too. That comes from brands too. Like brands have become increasingly manipulative, given that they know we're spending our attention on certain platforms. Hypercapitalism has responded with live stream selling, and it's all of this, the gamification of the art of commerce, if you want to put it that way. There's a lot of things that you could almost say as being your generation has been tested on, almost like a global guinea pig generation that got tested on to see how you would respond en masse, right? So you can, if you understand the way you've been communicated to as being part of these sorts of experiments, again, if you understand that, you have a lot of power to manipulate those experiments. For example, one of the most exciting things I've seen that Generation Z has done is consumer protests against businesses. And this is where people will deliberately interact with the algorithms or the adverts of a particular brand in order to manipulate that brand's outcome. So I mentioned the whole like fact that you've got global consciousness, and many young people all across the world have been involved in protests around what's going on in Gaza. One of the things we noticed Generation Z was doing was picking on brands who had refused to take a stand about the atrocities going on there, And what the consumer activists did was got people who were not the target market of a particular brand. So say my brand is, I use this example all the time, it's a brand that sells sparkly Alice fans for six-year-old girls. And I have refused or I've said something inflammatory about a particular global context. I have not been an ally for the future or an ally for the values that young people believe in. What young consumers would do is they would deliberately organize online to go and mess with my Alice Band brand's algorithm by getting, for example, 20-year-old men to go and click on my advertisement. So my advertisement is served to people who are never going to buy my product, and my ad budgets is absolutely burned through. This is what like young consumer activists are doing. Like, how clever is that, right? So that's like using the weaponization of hypercapitalism against the sort of the perpetuators of such tools. Very similar, but a much more sort of more serious political space. We've seen young people, for example, booking up seats at Trump's first election campaign so that the Trump campaign thinks that the stadium for that stop on the tour is full. And then when they show up, no one is there because people booked seats and they were never intending to go there, right? So you see how you can like kind of use the system against the system if you start thinking it like that way. And you are aware of the fact that every brand, every political party wants you, needs you, and is courting you. That's a huge amount of power. Of course, you might, as an individual, might feel disempowered, but en masse, you can start to see how working with people who think like you, organizing globally, you can make real material and political sort of trouble and costs for very, very big brands and businesses and global leaders. I mean, this is what ordinary young people can do, which is just really incredible when you start to use your agency and your power rather than feeling helpless. You got to kind of like organize. So this is like a really peaceful revolution, but still getting back where things hurt. So that was interesting.
It is interesting how activism has changed and we are using technology to take action. It's very, very interesting.
Yeah, definitely. I'm amazed by the messing with the algorithm, especially from someone who's like, what does the data tell us? And it's like, yes, we did that deliberately. The data is telling you something very wrong. How have these generational values across the different generations influenced movements such as the one you made now, or social justice movements and cultural shifts?
Yes, I think that comes back to what I was saying right at the beginning. You've got access to global information. You can see firsthand both the wealth and the excesses of celebrities. You know what they look like. We know what their houses look like. I mean, when you were tiny children, there was MTV Cribs, and now that you're older, you've got every celebrity does like sing songs in their bedrooms. You know, like, you know what wealth looks like, but at the same time, you know what pain looks like because you've got people in the middle of war zones sharing their lived experience. So it's unavoidable. On the one hand, this means you've got global consciousness, but on the other hand, it means you've got global responsibility, because once you know something, the excuse of ignorance no longer exists. And I know Carmen and I have had this conversation too, right? So there is a sort of responsibility that comes with that connection and with that information that you have access to there.
Okay. Just maybe, Bali, sorry, do we have any questions in the chat?
Yes, so we have a question from Carmen saying, with the rapid developments in America and the borderless nature of global technology, what key risks or considerations should we be mindful of?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much going on with that in terms of like the risks that come along with this. Of course, anything valuable is something that's also desirable, which could mean it's also like it's in need of protection. And that, of course, refers to your attention, it refers to your points of view, it refers to your mind, and it, of course, refers to your wallet too. So like on the more sort of prosaic threats are around identity theft, are around accessing people's information to manipulate them, whether that's blackmailing people through AI-generated porn, all the way through to anything else. You know, like there's a whole lot of real threats that come with this connection to everything. But one of the biggest threats that we need to be aware of is, coming back to my conversation around scarcity and abundance, is that the risks of abundance are being used to weaponize the threat of re-emerged scarcity, if you want to put it that way, of information. So that's like a very drawn out way to say that things like censorship and things like surveillance are becoming more ubiquitous and more global. In the name of protection against abundance, many people are being manipulated into accepting a new era of unnecessary scarcity. So there's two different types of scarcity in terms of economics. You've got real scarcity. Like there are only so many beachfront properties, right? Not everybody can have a beachfront property. That's a hard constraint. I mean, Dubai can put as much sand in the sea as it likes. It's never going to make it, you know, beachfront homes for every person on the planet. There's far too many of us. It's a real scarcity. There's only so much gold in the ground. That's real scarcity. You know, there's only so many chickens that are available at any point in time, real scarcity. But artificial scarcity is when it comes to, say, for example, putting up paywalls on content or making sure that information is limited and only available to people who have a license. I don't know if you're aware that in places like both India and Tanzania, governments have tried to make influencers or content creators take out licenses. So they've rationed the ability to speak as well as the ability to consume information, right? So that's an artificial form of scarcity that's designed to sort of reimpose ignorance, because ignorance is where fear breeds, and ignorance is, of course, where people can be more manipulated. So I think that those are some of them. That's probably the thing that you should be most aware of in your generation, the scarcities that are being posed upon yourselves and upon future generations in the name of nominal safety. Because a lot of these constraints are sold to us through politicians or through businesses to protect us from the things that we're not supposed to know, which is very medieval. I mean, the Catholic Church tried to do this with the printing presses, said that only priests, you know, were responsible enough to consume information that's found in books, right? People should remain ignorant for their own safety because they're not, you know, competent enough or capable of being judicious enough to evaluate information as being mis- or disinformation. So don't let anyone insult you in your generation in that regard. Again, it comes back to you have to know you have more wisdom than some regulator when it comes to evaluating things. But that, of course, means that that responsibility lies on you too. So I think that that's the one that I'd be most interested in following. And of course, there's like signals we can back this up with America, like putting out lists of words that people aren't allowed to use or they're going to get their funding denied, like words like women or LGBT or gender, for example. These are artificial scarcity constraints that are being put on people that you should be aware of and try to push back against.
Ron, maybe a few more lighthearted questions, and some maybe that are a bit directed to your personal experience. What are some things that have shocked you, surprised you, and delighted you about these generations? Do you have a favorite, dare I ask?
Oh, yeah, I definitely have a favorite. We did quite a big research study last year, my company Flex Trends with Student Village, who is a youth research agency. And we spent a lot of time with Generation Z 30 years on from the dawn of democracy, like that born-free generation, figuring out what people thought about politics, economics, society, family, all the rest of it. And my favorite one was when it comes to retirement, your generation is very optimistic about yourself. So you clearly have a lot of self-belief. Many of you think that you're going to retire by the age of 40, which is incredible, because I tell you, and Carmen will back me up here, 40 comes at you real quick. But the optimism that came along with that and the self-reliance was really heartening. And the other thing that's really unique about South African Gen Zs, which is a huge strength that you should definitely lean into, is that South African Gen Zs have friends. This sounds like, why am I talking about this? Well, that's because globally, a lot of people don't have friends. Globally, around a quarter of people under the age of 40 have no friends at all. In other words, no deep ties, no one to rely on when you get stranded somewhere with, say, like a blown out tire or your phone's died. No one to call for help. No one to look after your kid if you need a break, right? You have to pay a stranger to look after your child because you've got no friend or family member you can rely on. South Africans are different. We have both horizontal and vertical strong ties. Horizontal means friends. We have friendship support groups and friendships that are not based on transactional relationships. A transactional relationship is like paying a nanny to look after your kid. A non-transactional relationship is you look after your friend's dog this weekend, I'll look after your friend next week. You know, we care for each other. And we also have vertical strong ties. That is, we have actual relationships, shockingly, with our parents and with our grandparents. Multi-generational living is cross-culturally quite a unique marker of African and South African in particular culture. And it gives us so much strength and so much resilience and so many people to rely on, even in very constrained times, right? You know, we have high unemployment, and yet young people, as much as they're struggling to find a job, still have someone to look after them or to work with them or to help support them with studies. And this was something that came through so strongly in our research, and it's a beautiful thing. And although we take it for granted, maybe, hopefully we don't, it's an absolute rarity across much of the rest of the world, where children are pretty much kicked out of the nest when they reach maturity and they're expected to look after themselves. And also, where friendships have become so transactional that people in some parts of the world will send you an invoice after they've invited you over to their house for dinner. I mean, can you imagine? You host a braai and then you send everyone a request for payment for their share of your hospitality. This is normal in many parts of the world. So just know how lucky you are to just have friendship and fellowship that isn't all transactional based. And I think that's something so beautiful the rest of the world can learn from us.
Yeah, that is beautiful. Wow. It's so interesting to learn that what is your norm is actually someone else's, you know, exceptional.
Exactly. It comes back to what we started with, your context in space and time, your culture, the connections you have, your perspective does shape you. It shapes your values. It makes you feel that it's awkward to, like, why would you not be so hospitable to people? But for other people, that sort of selfishness is the way they were raised. So, you know, understanding that, you understand people, where they're coming from, and that's where you can start to build bridges.
Okay. And then maybe one more from me. If you could bring back something, a piece of technology or, a trend from your time, what do you think needs a comeback?
That's so funny. I think I'm a mother of like a small child now, and what kids don't have anymore is like play dates. And I think this is coming back to that thing. You've got these, your generation still has deep ties, but now it's like strange. And most children don't even have parties anymore, right? Like kids don't invite each other to birthday parties. And my kid goes to she goes to an international school. So there's people of all different backgrounds, but it seems to be normalized that families are becoming more insular and that like kids aren't encouraged to form their own friendships at their own level. And I think that that's something we need to bring back so that we can preserve this really rare, precious luxury we have in South Africa of having deep ties. So I think that's something I'd like to see a bit more of, as much as I don't want to drive around, you know, it's a different party every weekend. I recognize the value of that sort of generosity of spirit that would be good to lean back into.
Thanks, Brian.
Just one last question for me. How do we then prepare for the next generation to continue with these ties or the connection that we have right now, the human connection that we have right now with each other?
Yeah, that's a hard one, and that's, I'm largely going to put that ball back to your court, because we do emulate the patterns that we see from our parents. Your generation is moving into, and although statistically many of you will have less children than previous generations did, many of you will still have children, and the values that you instill in them, the effort you put into those relationships, and also the freedoms you give your children to interact with other children, not from a place of fear, but from a place of, again, sort of abundance, and not from a place of only letting your kid kind of play with people that look and sound and have the same socioeconomic background, which is such a temptation in our society. As we put up more walls and more booms and more gates, you know, we become so much more insular. So sort of not becoming comfortable with insularity is something that you have to keep on working at, because the more of those ties we have, the stronger, more resilient our society is. And it's one of the reasons why South Africa is so resilient, are those deep ties across generations and across the sort of vertical connections. And then, of course, just yourselves, just maintaining your friendships and not falling into the trap of Americanizing your friendships and keeping score and record, which is such a non-sort of South African thing to do. Just because Americans are doing it or Europeans or Germans or Dutch are doing it doesn't mean that it's normal or nice or right. And we have a right to perpetuate our own values. So keep those ties warm and fuzzy and care based, and resist the temptation of transactionalizing everything, And I would encourage that too when it comes to your dating relationships, which we've already transactionalized, unfortunately, in South Africa too. This idea of seeing your romantic partner as a bank balance and a give and take, and try, as soon as you keep score, I mean, this is like, that's the poem they read at, or the Bible verse they read at weddings, you know, like, love does not keep score. Like, try not to keep score. Try to understand that there's intrinsic as well as extrinsic benefits to your relationships, because those trends will perpetuate depending again on how you invest in them or not.
That is so true. Thank you so much for joining us and for sharing such valuable insights. Dimpho, thank you as well for adding a great perspective. And Buddy, thank you for keeping the conversation going. And of course, thank you to all those that joined. And that is it from us today.